So we were talking about middleware systems last time. We talked about Enterprise Java Beans as an example of a middleware system that is Java based and object oriented. Today we will talk about three other middleware systems: Korba, DCOM, which is Microsoft's middleware for building distributed applications, and then we'll talk about Genie, which is another Java middleware, but very different from the others that we have spoken about or discussed. So this is an overview of Korba. Korba stands for Common Object Request Broker. So what is at the heart of this middleware, or the layer that actually is responsible for a lot of the communication between middleware, is called a broker, object request broker, or an ORB. Okay? As the name suggests, there are objects, they make requests, and the requests flow through this ORB layer. Okay, so there are those boxes, there are various services that the middleware provides for applications that are written on top. And so these are application objects. Those are all objects that the middleware itself provides, and objects communicate with one another through the ORB layer. That is the interface that is used. It's the core of the middleware platform, and its communication between objects and clients. And that this layer could be either implemented as a library or as a separate process. And we'll see what all services Korba allows you to use when you design your own application. So it's a fairly heavyweight middleware in that it provides lots and lots of different services, that any possible service that you could think of when you want to implement your own application would probably be provided either in the general purpose service or the domain specific service. And there's a list of them here. We won't go into all of them, but just to give you some examples, there's a query service. If your application wants to query some data, you have a query service that's provided, you can use that interface. There's a concurrency service. If you want to write application that has threading, you can just use the concurrency service and your code will be threaded for you by the middleware. Okay? There's a transactional service which allows you to implement transactions inside your application. There is a notification service that we will talk about, and an event service that those two will talk about in more detail. There is even a licensing service. If you write a commercial application, you want to sell it and write a give licenses to your customers, there's a service for that as well. So you will see that there are a whole bunch of, there's a security service here to implement encryption and things like that. So essentially the middleware is somewhat heavyweight in that it provides these different functions. When you write an application, rather than writing code to perform much of this functionality, you can directly use Korba interfaces and use these services. Okay, that's the basic idea behind some of these services. Now, one of the problems of having such a large, heavyweight middleware is that it makes your application designer's job somewhat easier once you master the middleware. Okay? Just learning the middleware is going to be an effort because of the various different functions it provides to you. Okay, but once you learn it, then it is somewhat easy. So if you want to write a small application, there may be too much of a learning curve. If you're writing a large complex application, it's well worth your trouble to learn some of these functions and then use them. Okay. So here's a picture that shows how clients and servers communicate in Korba. As you will see, it is an RMI based interface. So you will see that there is this ORB layer at the bottom. Okay, that's the one that is also going to perform RPCs or RMIs in this case for you. Okay, there's an ideal proxy, that's the stub. Okay? The ideal proxies allow you to write your methods using an interface definition language. IDL stands for an interface definition language. You run it through an IDL compiler, it provides you the stub code. The stub code is actually going to handle setting up the connections and all of the stuff that we talked about when we did RPCs. Okay? And then there is the application that sits on top, the server side and the client side. Now, there is an invoke operation that allows you to invoke this operation, invoke this method. Okay, we won't go into some of these details here, just for the high level. The different kinds of object invocation that are supported here, we've run through them earlier. There is synchronous RPCs or RMIs in this case, that's your standard blocking-based interface to make method invocation. You can do one way. Okay. Remember when we were talking about RPC semantics, we talked about synchronous, asynchronous, one-way, deferred synchronous. So Korba is an example of a system that allows you to do one-way calls. Okay, you don't wait for an acknowledgement, the delivery is best effort. Okay? You also have deferred synchronous, okay, which means you basically have two asynchronous one-way calls, one in the forward direction, one in the reverse direction, which is called deferred synchronous. Okay? And you'll see that they have different failure semantics. There's at most one is best effort, okay, so both of those are supported in Korba. So those are all things that we have looked at previously. Now we'll look at one service that we haven't actually encountered before, which is the event and notification service. Okay. In Korba, we have this notion of an event channel, okay, which is what is used to implement what are called publish subscribe applications or PubSub applications. I don't know if anyone has heard the term PubSub. Okay. What happens in a publish-subscribe, it's a producer-consumer paradigm where consumers of data or events are going to subscribe to certain types of event and tell the middleware, say, anytime this type of event or this type of data is available, deliver it to me. So you're subscribed to certain kinds of data. Publishers are going to publish data. They are the creators of data. Okay? And they simply hand it to the middleware. Okay, this is how a typical PubSub application works. Okay, in Korba, it's very easy to write a publish-subscribe application because there is this notion of an event service and a notification service. And the main abstraction, there is an event channel. Think of this as a buffer. Okay? The suppliers or the publishers are going to publish data. They come and sit in the buffer. Okay, that's the event channel. And then the event channel will deliver that data to the subscribers. Okay? Not all data is going to go to all the clients. Okay? Depending on what you have subscribed, only a selection of the data is going to be made available to you. Okay? So the consumers have to tell the middleware what kind of events or data they want. Okay? You could say, I want a data that matches a certain criteria, and you basically specify that to the event channel. Whenever any data is published, you check all the various criteria, and whenever there's a match, you're going to deliver it to the subscribed entity. Okay? That's the notion of how publish-subscribe works in the context of an event channel. Okay? We will see that there are two ways to implement publish-subscribe. Here, what is shown is a push-based paradigm. Okay. So you do push-push, which is that the supplier is going to push data or events to the event channel. Okay. And the event channel will look at the subscription and depending on the matches, push that data to the consumer. Okay. So the consumer is just going to wait and listen for any events or data to arrive and things will be pushed to you from the event channel. Okay. Here is a pull-based model, same event channel, also supported in Korba, but now it is pull-based. What happens in pull-based is the event channel is going to pull data from the suppliers or the publisher. You are going to poll, saying, do you have any data? You keep polling. Whenever there is any data, you basically are going to pull it and it will be stored here. Okay? And the subscribers in return are also going to pull from the event channel. Every once in a while, they'll go and say, do you have any matching data for me? Okay? And you keep pulling in this fashion. Okay, so your data is going to get pulled. So this is a pull-pull model. Okay. Now, so you can have any combination of push and pull between the event channel and the producers and subscribers and the event channel. So we saw push-push and we saw pull-pull. But this could be push and that could be pull, or any combination is allowed. So now by default, you either want to keep it simple and say everything is push or everything is pull, but you can have any combination between the event channel and the publishers, the event channels and the subscribers. Okay. So the last thing in Korba that we are going to look at is asynchronous method invocation. Okay. So this is basically the way you do asynchronous RPC. This is the implementation of it. Okay. There are two ways by which you can make an asynchronous RPC and not wait for a response. Okay, so asynchronous RPCs or RMI simply allow you to send off a request to a server and then continue execution. Okay, the response is delivered to you at a later time. Okay, so that raises the question, when the response actually comes from the server, the response to the RPC or RMI comes from the server, how is the application to know that the response has arrived? So there are again two ways that Korba allows you to do this. One is you have what is called a callback interface. Callback interface is equivalent to saying interrupt me when the response comes back. So what you actually do is you register a callback function saying when the response comes back, invoke this function. You tell that to the middleware. In this case, you tell that to the ARP. So when the response actually comes back, then the ARP is going to actually invoke the registered method saying, and the registered method could be something like process respond, or you could write a method like this. So whenever a reply comes back, this process respond method that you've registered is called. Okay, this is called referred to as a callback mechanism. Okay. It's a generic mechanism in the distributed system where you want to asynchronously receive responses, you're going to ask for a callback. Okay. What may be another mechanism you can use for asynchronous replies?
Continuously polling a mailbox kind of.
Okay. So the other response, other method is to poll. Okay, there are only two ways. Either you tell the middleware notify me, or you keep asking the middleware as the reply comes. These are the two very standard ways by which you can look for a reply. So you also have a polling interface here. In this case, there's not going to be an interrupt. A reply is going to come back and is going to be buffered at the ARP, and it's the client application's job to periodically go and poll, saying has the reply come. Okay, there's a polling interface here, which is a non-blocking interface. Okay. Whenever you call it, it's going to say yes or no. If it's no, you go back and continue doing something. At a later point, you keep polling again. Okay? The reply has come, it will be given to you when you poll. Okay? So there are these two mechanisms for asynchronous remote method, which is a callback interface where you are interrupted and a polling-based mechanism. Okay. So that is a very quick overview of CoreBot. Are there any questions on this? So the main takeaway is heavyweight middleware, quite sophisticated in the variety of services it provides. Right? Supports publish subscribe applications, okay, which is one of the main reasons it is actually was used widely, and that is done through this notion of an event channel. And you basically subscribe to certain kinds of events or data. Whenever such data is published, it will be pushed or pulled. It will push or pull it. Okay. As far as the commercial side of CoreBot is concerned, there were many products that implemented the CoreBot middleware. But overall, the middleware was not a big commercial success. Okay. It was too heavyweight for application programmers. Okay. And also had a performance implication. Okay. It was not so much as the learning curve was hard. There are smart programmers out there. But even if you use it, if your application runs really, really slow because every simple call requires you to call the middleware does a lot of processing and then something happens, your application slows down tremendously. Okay, performance can be a big barrier. If your application runs very slow, you will say this is not very useful for me. I have a simple application and it runs really slow even on very high-end hardware. Okay. That was one of the reasons it actually did not become a commercial success. As I mentioned last time, the only widely used application of CoreBot, okay, that you may have encountered is if you have used a Linux desktop, okay, a Linux-based desktop that used the GNOME desktop manager. In Linux, there's a variety of desktop managers. There's KDE, and there's GNOME, and there's a whole bunch of others. GNOME is built on a lightweight version of CoreBot. It uses event channels for publish, subscribe, your X Windows applications that communicate with one another. The underlying layer in GNOME for all of this communication is CoreBot based. Okay. If you actually turn on the logs or if you look at the console log, you'll occasionally see some CoreBot message popping up saying notification failed or something like that showing up. That tells you that there is CoreBot under. But it's a significantly stripped down version of CoreBot. Okay. It is a standard that uses the same interface but doesn't use all of those functions. There are some commercial applications as well that still use it, but by and large, it did not go very far in terms of wide adoption. And the main reason is it was too heavyweight, which caused a performance issue. Okay. So next up is DCOMP. This is Microsoft's middleware stack. Okay. CoreBot came from the Unix world. EJBs are from the Java world, is the middleware. CoreBot is sort of the Unix world of middleware, and this is the Microsoft Windows world. Okay. Now, this is also a very complicated middleware, but it has evolved over time. Okay. And when you write Windows applications, this is basically the most common one that you use. In fact, if you write a program in something like C sharp or any of these languages, today BCom is now called .NET. You must have heard of .NET if you know about Windows. So basically underneath it are some of these components. The .NET is more than just DCOM, but DCOM is sort of the middleware layer that powers .NET. Okay, so we look at a little bit about what these layers mean. Okay. So you'll see that there are at least three different layers here which have resulted in the evolution of DCOM. At the very bottom is something called COM, okay, which is basically a communication library that supports RPCs and RMI. There's something called OLE, which is acronym for object linking and embedding. And then there is ActiveX, okay, which is the next evolution. And I'll talk a little bit about the history. Okay. So DCOM is actually a successor to what was called COM in the old days. Okay. So this is a distributed version of COM. And here is sort of the reason all of this came about. Okay. So this comes from actually the Microsoft Office side of Windows, not actually Windows itself. Okay. So back in those days, people would draw, let's say, a figure in PowerPoint, and then you want to put that figure into a Word document. A very common scenario, you draw figures in PowerPoint, you are writing a Word document, you bring that document and you import it. So what this required you to do was for Microsoft Office products to somehow communicate with one another for this to take place. That led to the design of COM, and then what also it led to was the design of this OLE layer, which is object linking and embedding, which explicitly allows you to embed one kind of document or object into another. The entire document is treated as an object. Okay? You can perform operations on the object. Okay? So you can take a picture and you can put it into Word, and then say if you want to edit it, you can actually double click on that picture and it will open up in PowerPoint. The way that happens is Microsoft Word will take that object, send it off to PowerPoint, make an RPC call, call PowerPoint, and PowerPoint will open with the document. You edit it, you save it, it will come back to Office, or rather Word. Okay? In this case, Microsoft applications are talking to one another. They are passing data. The data happen to be documents, pictures, spreadsheets that you have written. Same way you can write a spreadsheet and embed that as a table into a Word document, for instance. So you can have Microsoft Charts was another application where you could draw figures or graphs and embed it into documents of various sorts. Okay. So that was the reason all of this came about, which was, so they said it is useful for users to take any object that you created with one Microsoft Office application and somehow import it into another. And then rather than, if you want to modify it, rather than taking the data back, if you simply allow them to edit it from the same document, but it opens up into the original application, and then you make modification, that makes it all easy. And the way this is happening is underneath there's a communication layer that allows these applications to talk to one another. Okay? So that is what led to the design of OLE and the COM layer, which was basically a communication. So this was the original one, was OLE. It was soon subsumed by a more flexible RPC layer called COM, which allowed you to do this for any application, not just Office application. Okay, they saw that you can have other Windows services, you may write your own applications, now you want an RPC layer. So that was basically replaced by COM. Eventually what happened is that that got replaced by yet another implementation. Okay, they keep changing the names on this, so every 5 years there's a new name for the same thing. It was now then called ActiveX. This was also then embedded into Internet Explorer. Okay, so in those days you could actually have interactive applications in Internet Explorer. Those were written in this language or a layer called ActiveX. Today you write it in JavaScript and things like that that are standard across platforms. But in those days you could write this application that ran inside of your browser using what were called ActiveX control. They gave you menu-like drop-downs in a browser and things like that. Okay, it also was based on this notion of COM and so on. Okay. And what DCOM does is all of these things, but now distributed. Okay, not all objects or applications or just need to stay on the same machine. They can go across machines. Okay, this just makes the entire concept distributed. Okay. That's sort of the history behind DCOM. Okay, now today, as I said, DCOM has itself evolved into a more generic layer called .NET, which allows you platform independence. It allows applications written in one language to invoke applications written in another language through this middleware layer and so on, which is all about RPCs and RMI. And layered on top is the ability to drag and drop pictures and documents into one another for these office and other applications to talk to one another. Layered on top is ActiveX, which allows you to do controls and scripting and so on, okay, across this application. And then when you have these components on independent machines and they talk to one another, you have DCOM. Okay. So with that history, let's talk a little bit about the architecture. Okay, the architecture of DCOM doesn't look very different from CORBA. Okay, the terminology is all different, okay, but the concepts are the same. In CORBA, there is something called an interface repository, which is where each method is going to store its interface. And another method wants to import the interface, you're going to go to the interface repository and import it. At that point, you can invoke methods on that object. Same concepts too in DCOM, you have what is called a type library. It is actually going to be communicating with something called the service control manager, which is equivalent to a registry, which is where you are going to register the interface and so on. Okay, this is equivalent to the Windows registry that you may have heard of. That is a service control manager that's going to query the interface and so on. You'll see the stub here. Okay. This COM layer is the same as the ORB layer in CORBA. Okay, it's responsible for doing the inter-process communication, RPCs and so on. This is the stub layer. Okay, in fact, it's called a stub on the server side. Here it's just called a proxy. Okay. So this is the client stub, that's the server stub, that's the application code that you actually write. Okay, all of this is the middleware. This is the part that a programmer actually writes. Okay. Same thing is true on the server end. This is the code that you write. All of this comes from a tool. Okay, this is the stub, that's the COM layer, that's the service control manager and so on. Similar concept, okay, just implemented in the Windows world. Okay. Now, there's one interesting aspect of DCOM, which is the ability to persist objects. Okay. Typically, when you create an object, its state is stored in memory. Okay, if the process is terminated, the object goes away. Okay, just as all memory state of any process is lost, the same is true of any objects. Okay. In DCOM, you are allowed to make the object persistent. By default, when you instantiate an object, it's going to be transient, like you see in Java and so on. Okay, but you can also make it persistent by saying that this should be a persistent object. In that case, it's the middleware's job to take the object state and keep a copy on disk. Okay, this way, if the process is restarted, you can load that object state and the object will be exactly the way you left it before the process crashed or was terminated. Okay. Now, persistent objects are implemented using this concept called moniker, which is simply a fancy term for a handle that allows you to go back and read the object. Think of it as a file name, an object has a unique name that you can specify and then you can go and retrieve that object state and load it into your application and modify it and save it back. Okay. So basically, this persistent object has all the information necessary to recreate the object at a later time. Okay, so I'm going to show you some examples of persistent objects. So here is a class moniker, which is essentially the main kind of persistent object. This is typically an object that you are going to store. You can have a file as a persistent object. By default, a file is a persistent data structure. You basically always store it on disk, you can get it back. But you can create a file object in CORBA, rather in DCOM, which allows you to retrieve the file from disk, modify it, and then it will be stored back automatically for you. Okay? There are URL objects and there are the composite objects. So you can have one object inside another object. Okay. This may be used, for instance, to create a Word document that has a PowerPoint figure or has a table that is imported from, let's say, Microsoft Excel. Okay. That's a composite object that has one object embedded into another object. And that's a persistent object. Clearly, you don't want your document to disappear because you quit PowerPoint or Word. So that's automatically going to be stored for you when Microsoft Office is using this underlying framework. Okay. So that's an important takeaway, okay, is that in DCOM and also to some extent in all modern middleware, even in EJBs and CORBA, you can have objects that persist. Okay. This is how you can basically keep state on disk that is going to be whose lifetime is longer than the process lifetime. Okay. you want to keep that state. When you restart the application, you want the state to be there. Okay? Typically, when you write your own application, you may create files and you may store data in files and retrieve it. You want to do this in an object-oriented way. You simply encapsulate and get this state into an object and make that object, call that object a persistent object. Okay? That clear? So, last thing that we are going to spend the next half an hour or so talking about is what is referred to as distributed coordination. It's a different middleware. The example of this middleware is Genie middleware. But the reason it exists is slightly different from all of the others we have talked about. So, before we even talk about it, I will give you some sort of an overview of what this middleware is trying to do. Okay? So, distributed coordination is a way to write distributed applications that are loosely coupled. Okay? By loosely coupled, we mean that we don't know which component will talk to which other component when we even write the application. Mostly when you write a client-server application, you know that the client part of the code is going to talk to the server part of the code, and that's how it is written. In distributed coordination system, you have components, but you don't know who is going to talk to whom a priori. This happens at runtime. And we'll see why that is important, why we even need to write applications like that. But before we do that, let me give you some example here. So if you take the various communication models for applications that we have seen so far, you can partition them into four quadrants, depending on how communication takes place in time, which is called a temporal dimension, and how communication takes place in space, called the referential or the spatial component. Either of these could be coupled or uncoupled. The most common one is what is called direct communication, where you are coupled in space and time. What that means is both when you are coupled in time, that means the client and the server are both present at the same time. Both the entities in the communication are coupled in time, when they both run at the same time and they talk to one another. When you are coupled in space, what that also means is the client and the server know a priori who they are talking to. This is also referred to as direct coordination. Okay. Here is another example called the mailbox method of coordination, which is uncoupled in time but coupled in space. Email is an example where the sender and the receiver can communicate without the sender and the receiver being present at the same point in time. I can send an email to someone. They can read it at a later time. They don't have to read it when I'm sending it. Okay. Communication is decoupled in time. Okay. When the message gets read, is not when it was sent. Okay? But it is coupled in space in that the sender knows who they are sending the mail to. Okay? Your mail actually has an address and you know who you are addressing your communication to. Okay? So the sender and the receiver are coupled in space, which means they know who they are talking to. But the temporally they are decoupled. Okay? Because you can send a mail and it's read at a later time. Okay? That's a different form of communication. Here is another one, which is called meeting room oriented communication. This is coupled in time, but decoupled in space. Okay, what that means is, a meeting room communication is you call a meeting and say, everybody who wants to come to this meeting room, this conference room at noon. Okay? So all of the communication is going to take place at the specified time. So it's coupled in time, but it's not coupled in space because who all may show up is not clear ahead of time. You invite, you said, if you want to come, come. And then whoever shows up will talk to one another. Okay? This is referred as a meeting room oriented model, where people show up, but you, a priori, you don't know who all will show up. But you know when this communication will take place because the time is specified. Okay? So that's basically coupled in time, decoupled in space. Yeah, the most general one is decoupled in time and space. That's what we'll talk about, where you don't know when you send a message, when the message will be picked up. And when you send the message, it's not addressed to anyone in particular. Right? You basically just address it more generically, and whoever is interested comes and picks it up. Right? Now we'll see why such communication is, why should you ever send a message without knowing who it is supposed to be for and when it is going to be delivered. Now, why does that even make sense, we'll talk about, but that is the most general one. So this is the most loose form of communication. Application components are communicating without knowing who the intended recipient is or when the message will be delivered or picked up. Okay. All right. So let's talk about Gini, and now it'll probably become clear why these loose coordination models are actually useful. Okay? So Gini is a Java-based middleware, okay, that allows you to discover new services on the fly and use them as and when you want them. Okay? And the best example of this is, let's say you go, you take your tablet or your laptop computer and you show up to your friend's house or your friend's dorm room or whatever to work on a project. Okay? And now you want to print something on a printer. Okay? It's a new environment, so typically you may not have configured a printer a priori. Okay? You may have configured printers for your own home or your office or whatever, but not in your friend's environment, okay? Their network environment. So there are now, if you want to print, there are two ways to do this. You ask your friend saying, do you have a printer? What is its address? And then you put in the address, you basically configure a printer, and then you print. Okay? There's one way to do it. Another way to do it is your machine is smart enough, it goes and discovers what printers are nearby. Okay? And it's going to show you a list of printers. Okay? And then you just say, go print on this printer, and it just prints. You don't have to configure anything. This is also referred to as zero configuration models, okay, where you don't have to configure various services into your machine a priori. Whenever your machine is any network environment, it discovers what else is nearby, what machines are nearby, what printers are nearby, what access points are nearby, and all of that, and it just shows you. And when you want to communicate, it simply picks the one you want from the list and it's done. You don't have to configure this a priori. Okay. So this is an example of what is referred to as the discovery-based service. So your service has to allow you to go and discover these other entities in your environment, okay, and enable you to configure, use them without a system administrator configuring them statically. Okay. Now this is going to be a good convenience for users, because users don't want to deal with the task of, I want to print. Now before that, if I want to have to 10 minutes mucking around with my printer configuration, just making my machine recognize this printer, it's more work for the user. The machine is smart enough to discover everything and just show you everything that is nearby, okay, in your LAN environment. Nearby meaning it's on the same LAN, and then you just pick the printer and print. This life is much easier, okay, for the user. Okay. Now, this kind of discovery has to be done using loose coordination. Okay. One way to do this is a printer is going to announce saying, I am a printer. Okay. I am located at such and such room, okay, and it's going to just post this message. Okay. Now that message is not addressed to anyone in particular. Okay. Neither do you know whether that anybody will ever care about this message or not. Okay. At some later point in time, a laptop may come around and say, is there a printer nearby? Okay. And this printer has posted this message, and it can then go and say, yes, there is a printer. So I see this message, I pick it up, and I basically show that in my list. So this is the way basically communication works here. This is also referred to as a blackboard or a bulletin board model of communication. Okay. The loose form of communication that I described to you is exactly what happens on a bulletin board. Let's say you want to sell some furniture. Okay. You go and post a note. Okay. Note is not addressed to anyone in particular. It's a general announcement saying, I have this furniture to sell, or I'm selling this car. And then at some later point in time, somebody may come along, look at the bulletin board and say, is there something notice of interest to me that is posted on this board? They see that you're selling furniture. Maybe they want to buy furniture. So they're going to pick up your phone number tag at the bottom and call. This is how communication is enabled. Exactly the same way what I described in the printer world. There's a shared bulletin board where the printer has gone and posted it. Says, I am a printer. I'm at such and such location. Your machine, when it shows up, is going to go and look at the shared bulletin board, say, what are all the services that are available that have been posted here? And you go and pick them up from there. Okay? So this kind of model is referred to as a bulletin board model. It's somewhat like a publish-subscribe model, except that when you publish some data, it's not addressed to anyone in particular. Okay? You just publish a notice. And it just goes and shows up on the bulletin board, and at some later point, someone may come and query and show me all the printers, and then you will basically look at all the data that's been published on the bulletin board or your blackboard and pick up the data of interest to you. Okay. So this is basically how Gini works, or what the rationale for this kind of middleware is. Okay. So it is based on a bulletin board model. what is underneath is what is referred to as a Java space, which is your shared data store. Okay? That is your shared bulletin board. It's like a small database where you're going to post data and then others can query data, and it's distributed and shared. Okay, I'm going to show you a picture how this works. So this is basically the notion of a publish subscribe, which is also true in the Genie world. I already mentioned publishers publish data, they sit in a publish subscribe middleware and Genie, and this is the shared bulletin board. Subscribers are going to go and pick this data. Okay, that's a more general approach. This is basically how Genie works. Okay. So here is your shared Java space. Okay. These are the shared notices that I was talking about. These are data items. Here is an application that inserts a tuple. Okay, this is tuple A. Okay. And then it goes and sits in the bulletin board. It's not addressed to anyone in particular. Okay, it's just an announcement of some or publishing of some data. Here's another application that puts B. And there is some another one called C that is input. Here's an application that comes at a later time and say match for all tuples that match this criteria T. Okay, this may be give me all the printers, that's the criteria. C may be a printer announcement. Right? So in this case you are going to pick up C. Okay, you have the option of deleting that data once you picked it up or leaving it there for others to also pick up. Okay, it's a one-time notice, then you basically take delivery and you delete it from the bulletin board. If it's a generic announcement, it's going to stay there. Others, other applications that come along can also discover and take that data item. Okay. In this case, what is showing you, what is being shown here is you take C and you remove it, which is why it's grayed out. Okay, but you don't have to do that. Okay. Now this box that is shown here, that's called a Java space. That is your shared bulletin board, okay, that you have in this case. There are many ways to implement it that we'll talk about as well. Now, another way by which this model could work is asynchronous callbacks, where you basically register with your bulletin board and say, whenever any data of this type is published to the bulletin board, notify me. Okay? The previous one was poll-based, where you went and actually polled the bulletin board and picked up all matching data. Here is a notification-based delivery, where you request notification that whenever data that matches criteria T is published, let me know. Okay. And then eventually an application comes along and publishes this data item C. At this point, a notification is sent saying some data that matches your criteria has been published, and the application goes to the bulletin board, picks it up, and then maybe it optionally removes it. Okay. That is also equivalent to publish subscribe. So you can do publish subscribe using this kind of middleware as well. Okay, so this is basically two push and pull based models for delivery. Here are some implementations of this mechanism. Okay. The first one is these gray boxes, these black boxes are machines, they are connected on the LAN. The gray box is implementation of your Java spaces. So there are two ways to do this. Okay. One is what happens when you write and what happens when you read. If you are fully replicated, okay, then whenever you insert something into this bulletin board, your bulletin board is replicated on every machine. You are going to broadcast the write. Okay, whenever you attach a new notice to your bulletin board, you are going to replicate it. That's a write. Okay, so you are going to send it to every machine that has that bulletin board, and then basically every machine has a copy of it. Okay. Then reads are local in this case. When you want to read, you just ask your local copy. You don't have to go to another machine and try to read. But if you delete something from your local copy, you have to then notify all of the other shared entities saying that this object has been deleted, okay, for consistency reasons. Okay, that's just consistency maintenance. Okay, so this is basically write everywhere, read local. Okay, that's one way to configure your shared bulletin board. Shared bulletin board is replicated, all writes are broadcast, reads are local, deletions have to also be broadcast. Here is another implementation of it. This is a partitioned Java space, okay? Not a replicated. There is a version of the bulletin board on each machine, but it is partitioned. Think of it as I put a bulletin board on each floor of this building. Okay? Whatever is posted on the floor one may not be posted on floor two. So each bulletin board has a separate set of notices. Okay? So in this case, when you query, the queries have to be broadcast to all the bulletin boards, because we want to look in each one to see if there's any matching data of interest. Okay. Writes are going to be local. If you want to post a notice, you go to the local one and put it up there. You don't have to notify others. But when you do re-look everywhere to see if there's an item of interest, and then you pick those up. Okay, is that clear? So these are the two ways you can implement JavaScript. So either they are replicated or they are partitioned. Okay. In partition, just think of it as is the equivalent of a partition database, where every query has to be broadcast to all the partitioned entities, and you find all the matching queries, you merge them, and you get the results. So as far as Genie is concerned, so it was actually designed for embedded devices. Okay, so it was a Java middleware that was designed for things like phones or other intelligent appliances. So their vision was, you go into a home, you buy, let's say, an intelligent toaster or some washing machine or some such thing. You don't want to sit and configure your washing machine. That's not something people look forward to. So you want the washing machine to interact with other smart appliances in your home. Okay? Similarly, you have a phone or a tablet, it can go discover all the other devices that are there, whether they're printers or other network services. Printers were examples where of an embedded device where they wanted to put this thing in, okay? And use it. So, although again it was a good example of a distributed coordination middleware, it hasn't gone very far, because there are other mechanisms that have been put in place to do essentially this. Okay. So if you actually have a Mac, for instance, or Windows for that matter, you will see if you go into an environment, it can actually discover your printers and other devices. You can always see a list of all the Wi-Fi networks that are available to you. You'll often see a list of all the printers that are available to you. On Macs, then you will see lots of other things shared. You can share your iTunes library, for instance, and show you all nearby users that are shared their iTunes library. All of that is happening through an equivalent technique. On a Mac, it is referred to as, it should be called Bonjour, but now it's called a rendezvous mechanism. Rendezvous essentially allows you two parties to communicate without knowing a priori that they wish to communicate. Okay? Exactly a distributed coordination model. Okay. And so from there, you can then just go and find whatever service you want and use it. So basically, this kind of ideas have been used widely. Now, I should also mention that in the Windows and Mac world, there you have this notion of zero configuration, but there is no shared bulletin board. So the way it is actually implemented is, you don't go and force this data. Instead, you send periodic announcement that you listen to. Okay, one way is you actually go and put this notice on the bulletin board. Another is every 5 minutes you go and say, I am a printer. Okay, so you just listen for these announcements, and then you collect all of the notices. So you filter whatever ones you don't want, and the ones you want, you keep track of them and you show them. Okay, so same happens with your Wi-Fi network. And there is no shared bulletin board where you go and post your access point, and then when you say connect, it shows you all the list of available network. What's happening is your machine is simply listening for announcements from the access point, saying, I'm such and such access point, this is my SSID or this is my network name. Okay. So this is actually being done through a different mechanism rather than actually using a persistent bulletin board. You can broadcast your announcement. It is less efficient. As the number of these entities and services keeps growing, the number of broadcast messages will also keep growing. It is more efficient to post this once onto a bulletin board and simply go and look at it when you need to, rather than periodically broadcasting your presence to every entity that is on your LAN environment. But that is the way things are evolved. This was the way things were intended, that people intended for them to evolve. But then what actually happened is something slightly different. What people who designed Genie and other middleware systems wanted it to. That's not to say you cannot write an application in Genie. You can. It's still available as a middleware, but it's not used in the same way people had wanted it to be used. Okay. So that's the last point I wanted to make, was with Genie, was the way it has actually gotten used is this whole notion of not having a system administrator or not requiring a system administrator to configure your distributed system or application. Right? Just have the components of the application discover one another, configure themselves to talk to one another, and then you're ready to go. You don't have to a priori specify X needs to talk to Y, Y is on this IP address and this port number and so on. All of that gets discovered for you automatically. So that's basically a very good way by which you can design these network services. They are used more in the network service world rather than real distributed applications. You don't write a web server that goes and broadcasts its presence to everyone else. Okay, that's not the kind of application it's intended to. But there are lots of network services that are distributed, whether they are NTP-like services or other services. Using zero configuration to figure out which services are present, how to use them, is actually a good technique because you don't have to go and keep reconfiguring your system to discover them and use them for day-to-day use. Okay? So that's a good example of where these distributed coordination models are okay, through this mechanism called zero-conf or zero configuration. Okay? So I don't have much else today. I wanted to end the class early. I'll take questions if you have any questions. Otherwise, we will just do course evaluation and end. And then next time we have one last class remaining, we'll talk about distributed pervasive systems, which are sensor networks and sort of these class of distributed systems that are very resource constrained. Okay. We'll also talk a little bit about green computing and energy issues that are relevant both for the sensor networks as well as for server environment. Okay. That will be the last class and then we will end the course there. So for the rest of this class, I need somebody to help administer this course evaluation.